Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at an article written by J. Lee Grady a few years ago, just before the release of God's Not Dead, actually. Now, normally when I respond to an article, I just read it myself but with effects on my voice. This time, I've decided to try a text-to-speech service. It's not perfect, but I think it came out pretty well. So, without further ado, I present J. Lee Grady's 7 Things That Prove God Is Real.
Seven Things That Prove God Is Real. When I was a journalist in my 20s, I needed to verify a fact about atheism. This was before the internet age, so I phoned the Texas headquarters of American Atheists. Madeline Murray O'Hare, the mother of modern atheism in this country, answered my call. Apparently she had a very small staff.
Yeah, it's not about the size of the staff, it's how you use it. It was O'Hare's challenge to the compulsory Bible reading and prayer in her son's school that ended up going to the Supreme Court and won a ruling that said that forcing kids to pray or read the Bible in school is a violation of the Constitution in 1963. Now, I know that Christians often have a problem with this, but if you just please take one moment to have a little bit of empathy and consider other people's points of view on the matter, it's not hard to justify. Would you, as a Christian, want to live in a country where sending your kid to public school meant that they would be forced to read the Quran and pray traditional Muslim prayers? I would imagine not. It's not persecution to ensure that everybody is treated equally and that nobody's religion will be forced on people that don't share that religion. Rather the opposite, enforcing a culture where conformity to a specific religion is expected and anyone who deviates is treated differently is pretty much definitionally persecution. So, having mandatory Bible readings and prayer in school directly contributes to the persecution of religious minorities, while removing all mandatory prayer and Bible readings is just common decency. Now, please note, I am referring to staff-led prayer and Bible readings in these institutions here. The kids themselves are still welcome to read their Bibles in school if they want, and to pray. They just won't be forced to by the staff. Or rather, shouldn't be forced to. It still happens, and Christians still cry persecution, even while banding together to persecute others to the point where they fear for their safety and have to leave town.
Her voice was gruff, and she sounded angry and cynical, even before I identified myself as a Christian.
You just know this is going to be an excellent, unbiased evaluation of the actual evidence for God when they start off by assigning emotions to people without giving any context. Maybe she was just having a bad day. Maybe you just don't like her direct manner of speaking. You're trying to paint a picture of her as being a miserable woman with no joy, and you seem to want to tie that to her atheism. But can you really make that kind of a determination from one single interaction? I haven't seen a lot of her stuff, but from what I have seen, she seemed perfectly happy, but also passionate about church-state separation, which in the 60s was a touchy subject, so in order to actually get stuff done, she had to be fairly aggressive. And I think people mistake her aggressive, passionate stance on church-state separation for a general state of unhappiness. But in what I've seen of her, she seems way more relaxed and happy than all the preachers who get upset and worked up about porn or homosexuality. Now, here's a couple clips of her talking about swearing in an interview with Johnny Carson.
I use four-letter words exquisitely, delightfully, deliberately, and abundantly whenever they need to be used, and I very rarely scatter these pearls before swine. The most beautiful, the most satisfying, the most exhilarating thing that anybody really can do and do day in and day out and really feel good because of it is to have a bowel movement. Now,
That sounds like she was having a good time. She doesn't sound gruff or cynical. But, I mean, this is all more than a bit irrelevant. She may have founded American Atheists and had significant impact on the fight for church-state separation, but you can't judge all atheists based on your impression of the disposition of one single atheist, even if your assessment is correct, which it doesn't seem like it was.
She answered my question and I hung up. Ever since then, I've felt intense sadness for people who deny the existence of God.
Well, I'm sorry that you've wasted your time being emotionally unhappy about the fact that your God can't be bothered to show himself to everyone in a way that will result in their believing that he exists, but really there's no need to shed any tears over it. Many of us are much happier this way, and often those of us who are not happier as atheists are less happy because of the actions of the religious people in their lives who can't come to terms with the idea of them not sharing their religion.
Explaining her beliefs, O'Hare once said, "There is no God. There's no heaven. There's no hell. There are no angels. When you die, you go in the ground, the worms eat you. What a sad way to view life."
Whether or not it is sad is completely irrelevant to whether or not it is true. It makes me sad that my cat has a heart condition that pretty much guarantees that she will only be with us for another couple years, if we're lucky. If I were to decide that knowing that your cat is dying is a sad way to live, and so deny this fact, then maybe I would be happy for a short while, and I'd save a not insignificant amount of money on medication and vet checkups, but that would, in the end, have a significantly worse outcome than facing the unhappy truth that her time with us is more limited than is fair, and therefore do what we can to make her last years as comfortable and as happy for her as possible. I would rather deal with an unhappy truth head on than believe a comfortable lie, and in lots of scenarios, such an attitude will lead to better overall outcomes.
I'm sure Mrs. O'Hare would be upset about the new Christian film God's Not Dead, which opens in theaters this Friday. The film features Kevin Sorbo, who played in the 1990s TV show Hercules, as an atheist college professor who tries to force a Christian student, Shane Harper, to rethink his beliefs. The film releases at a time when atheism is growing in this country.
Whether or not she would be upset about it is just about as irrelevant as Kevin Sorbo's career.
I am a TV and film actor, and my name is Kevin Sorbo, and I can assure you that we did, in fact, evolve from filthy monkey men, and I don't know what that means.
And really, the entire God's Not Dead franchise is just a bunch of pandering and lazy writing meant to make a quick buck. And it worked. Its production budget was only $1.15 million, but it brought in over $96 million. So if you want to be proud at how oblivious the religious are to the fact that they are seen as gullible rubes by the people that make this sort of pandering tripe, then that's a you problem. But it also reinforces the gullible rube picture.
I was never on the debate team in high school, so I'm not the best guy to take on evolutionist Richard Dawkins or comedian/atheist Bill Maher in a televised argument.
Because really, the only possible way to get good at debating is to have been on the debate team in high school, right?
Still, my faith in God is certainly not shaken when I hear these guys whining about how stupid or weak Christians are. They have a constitutional right to view life negatively.
I haven't watched, listened to, or read either of them in a good long while, and I have some pretty significant issues with both of them, but I'm not sure I've ever heard either of them whine about Christians being stupid or weak. Certainly it is easy to get the impression that they have that opinion about Christianity as a whole, but people are not ideas. You can think that Christianity is stupid without thinking that Christians are stupid. Smart people can hold on to stupid ideas, and I'd actually wager that every person, regardless of intelligence levels, believes at least one idea that is a stupid idea. I'll even use myself as an example here. I was once a young Earth creationist. Young Earth creationism is a pretty stupid idea. But when I stopped being a creationist, I didn't suddenly get smarter. I probably have about the same intelligence level as I did when I was a creationist. Depending on how you measure intelligence, of course, it is a very complicated topic that I'm not going to get into here. But given how brains develop as we age, it's actually more likely that I'm slightly less intelligent now than when I was a creationist.
But if I had a chance to give them my reasons for believing in God, I would list these. 1. Babies. I watched my wife give birth to our 4 daughters, and last month I visited my new grandson.
So, look at the trees, but with babies instead of trees? Now, I watched my wife give birth to three of ours, and let me tell you, we were not designed very well for that process. At least two of my kids would not have survived if it were allowed to happen naturally. One came close to not surviving as it is, having been resuscitated immediately after birth, and then spending the first week of his life in an intensive care unit, followed by another couple weeks of having to constantly be on oxygen. I look at the human birthing process and think, what idiot designed that system? Then I remember that that system, according to the Bible, was made that way as a curse. God made childbirth a painful ordeal to punish women for the role that Eve played in the fall, that is, for doing something evil, before she had the knowledge of good and evil required to know that what she was doing was evil.
I've stared at little Hananiah's cute face and tiny fingers, and the cleft in his chin that resembles mine. How can anyone deny the reality of God when they see a baby?
I mean, from an evolutionary standpoint, it makes perfect sense that we would feel intense feelings of the variety that are often attributed to God when looking at babies, because that makes us feel protective of babies. And the better we are at protecting our babies, the more of them survive to have babies of their own. And really, the cute factor and feelings of attachment are kinda essential to a baby's survival, because when a sleep-deprived parent has to change not only a dirty diaper in the middle of the night, but also give the baby an emergency bath because they somehow managed to dig the shit out of their diaper and smear it all over themselves, and have to change the bedsheets for the same reason, and also have to wash the walls near the crib, the cute factor and feelings of attachment are the only immediate reward for tolerating that sort of thing. This example may or may not be based on a true story.
The amount of information encrypted in one cell in the human body is equal to that of 1,000 books.
That depends very much on how we're defining information, but that is entirely irrelevant. There's a lot of information contained in the configuration of a snowflake, but for some reason, apologists never go for that example. Maybe because it's actually an excellent example of emergent complexity happening naturally with nothing but the laws of physics to guide it.
The total amount of information stored in your DNA is 40 times more than that of the largest set of encyclopedias in the world.
Maybe the largest set of print encyclopedias, but the entirety of Wikipedia is a surprisingly small 19.5 gigabytes. The human genome is a measly 1.5 gigabytes in comparison, making Wikipedia 13 times larger than the human genome. Unless, of course, you do that thing where you multiply the genome size by how many cells there are in your body, and then assume that a copy of identical information counts as an increase in information, which I'm not actually sure if this particular person is a young Earth creationist or not, but if you count identical copies as more information, then duplication mutations are definitely capable of adding new information into our genomes. That might be irrelevant here, but statistically speaking, there is a not insignificant chance that the author of this article is a young Earth creationist. Now, lest I be accused of unfairly impugning his character, allow me to point out that he does run a charity that is dedicated to helping women who are victims of domestic violence, and he does file a Form 990 for that charity, so you can see where the money goes. I took a quick peek, and there is a chance that I'm not understanding it correctly, but it looks like about 43% of their income actually goes toward their programs, which is not a great ratio, but it's a hell of a lot better than the 22% that churches actually spend on their programs, though it might be worth mentioning that about 35% of the 43% of the income that they spend on programs is for their staff to attend retreats. Still, he does more for women's rights than your average church, which isn't really saying much, but it's better than nothing, I guess. The real question here is, how the fuck did I end up digging into charity financials when the size of the human genome was the starting point?
King David felt this sense of awe when he wrote, "You wove me in my mother's womb, I am fearfully and wonderfully made," Psalms 139:13-14, NASP. Life is truly a miracle.
I mean, I guess if you're comfortable going with some king whose historicity is disputed didn't understand gestation as an argument, I hope they get better from here.
2. Thunderstorms. I love to sit on my back porch in Florida and listen to the rumbling of thunder. It reminds me of God's majesty and power.
Okay, so look at the trees, but with thunderstorms instead of the trees this time. But really, if we're talking about God's power, how about hurricanes, tornadoes, and earthquakes rather than thunderstorms? They're even more powerful. Does God do them too? You know, those storms that cause over 10,000 deaths every year? Hell, even just run-of-the-mill thunderstorms can be deadly. Are these things the signs of a loving god, or are they just the kind of weather phenomena that we would expect to find on a godless planet?
The Apostle Paul said creation was the best evidence of God's existence. He wrote, "For since the creation of the world his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen," Romans 1:20. Nature is actually full of quantifiable miracles.
I suppose, if you define miracle loosely enough. I mean, some people consider the sunrise to be miraculous, and we have a pretty good handle on the physics of that one, so I would disagree that it's a miracle, but with that kind of wishy-washy definition, then there are lots of things that you could call miraculous.
Just consider the fact that the Earth is the perfect distance from the sun to support life. If we were any farther away from the sun, we would freeze. If we were even slightly closer to it, we would burn up. It's obvious God created this home for us.
Nope. First, the habitable zone around the sun is estimated to extend from 0.9 AU to 1.5 AU, with 1 AU being the average distance between the center of the Earth and the center of the sun. That's a range of 89 million kilometers that would work. And if you have trouble with numbers at this scale like I do, that's over 7,000 times the diameter of the Earth. On top of that, there are an estimated 40 billion planets in our galaxy alone that orbit in their star's habitable zone, so this placement is not special. And actually, no, that's a lie. The real number would be much, much bigger. That's just all the Earth-sized planets. And when you consider moons as potential places for life to develop as well, the number jumps up even higher, though admittedly the data is much more speculative with regards to exomoons than exoplanets, as they are much harder to detect. In fact, while we do have a number of candidate exomoon detections, none have as of yet been confirmed. But if moons are, on average, half as prevalent as they are in our solar system, then that would mean there are potentially 85 moons somewhere in each star system. Given the prevalence of moons that we know about, it is entirely reasonable to think that there are a plethora of large rocky moons orbiting planets in their stars' habitable zones, or making use of other forces to maintain liquid water, like the tidal forces that keep the oceans on Europa liquid. The placement of Earth in the habitable zone of our solar system is one of the least interesting features it has. And really, if you want proof of God, show me life existing in an environment that cannot sustain life. The fact that life developed where it is possible for life to develop is entirely expected in a godless universe. Where else would you expect to find life but in places where life is possible?
3. Flowers. There are more than 400,000 species of flowers in the world, and most of them are not edible. Their job is to simply make the world beautiful. Did they just haphazardly evolve over time, or did a loving God create each individual shape and color scheme for our enjoyment?
Okay, so now we're 3 for 3 on the proofs of God being variations on the look at the trees theme. Yes, flowers, designed specifically for our enjoyment, which is why they have patterns on them which can only be seen in ultraviolet wavelengths, wavelengths that humans are unable to detect, but which bees can see quite clearly. Because these flowers were designed to be pretty to us, right? They couldn't have evolved through mutualism to be attractive to the bees that pollinate them. It has to be designed specifically for human enjoyment, which is why their most beautiful patterns are those that aren't even visible to humans. But God's invisible attributes have been clearly seen, right? This must be what that verse means.
People who choose to deny God don't spend enough time looking at tulips, snapdragons, orchids, lilies, lotuses, or magnolias. This is why it's really important to stop and smell the roses.
People who believe in God don't spend enough time studying the tulips, the snapdragons, etc. They're much more interesting when we learn about them and how and why they do what they do, instead of just assuming that they were all made specifically for our enjoyment without having to understand anything about them. It wasn't religion that first pointed a UV camera at flowers and found out how differently they look to animals that can see UV light.
4. The Bible. Paul wrote that all scripture is inspired by God, 2 Timothy 3:16.
Okay, well, glad we moved on from the look at the trees argument. Too bad we moved on to an even worse argument.
The Bible itself is proof of God's existence because he used 40 unrelated people over a period of 2,000 years to write his unique love letter to us.
I mean, I guess that's a step up from Mike Riddle's "the Bible says God is real and the Bible is true because the Bible is the word of God, therefore God" argument, but it's still not great, especially considering the fact that the Bible in no way presents a cohesive narrative between all its books. Hell, it doesn't even manage to stay cohesive within single books. Hell, Mark can't even keep it straight through one chapter. In 16:8, he says that the women who went to the tomb ran away and said nothing to anyone out of fear. And then, with all of one sentence between the two statements, he goes on to say that one of the women at the tomb told some of the disciples. Of course, the eagle-eyed among you will have noticed that note in the middle there that points out that the earliest manuscripts don't include verses 9 through 20 because they were most likely not in the original. Mark just ended with the woman telling nothing to anyone. There are actually a number of places in the Bible where we can parse out which parts of the text were written by which different authors based entirely on discrepancies like this. So to say the whole thing has one cohesive message is just, well, naive at best.
There is nothing like the Bible because it carries the same consistent message throughout all of its 66 different books.
Except for when it doesn't, like when the author of John goes out of his way to explicitly contradict the Synoptic Gospels. Simon was forced to help Jesus carry the cross. No! Jesus is God! He doesn't need help, he carries his own cross! Jesus is tempted by Satan in the desert. No! Jesus is God! God cannot be tempted! Jesus asked for this cup to be taken away from him because he doesn't want to be crucified. No! Jesus is God! He wouldn't change his mind about something like that, and he certainly wouldn't be afraid of it, etc.
Atheists can laugh at this idea, but those who have read the scriptures and experienced God through its pages know why it is the best-selling and most translated book in all of history.
Not necessarily. I mean, most people buy their Bibles to look nice on their shelves or coffee tables. They don't get read. And as someone who is currently in the process of reading the Bible to my daughter and getting her thoughts on the matter, so far it's not really all that impressive. The stories are repetitive, God's more than a bit of a jerk, and all the quote-unquote good guys are usually manipulative assholes. Here's a small sample where my daughter summarizes a part of Genesis.
It's basically, I will be the God of your offsprings.
Yeah. And he likes to repeat himself.
Yeah. He's like, I will be the God of your offsprings, and I will be the God of your offsprings, and your offsprings, and I will be the God.
Of your offspring. And their offspring.
And their offspring.
And God said to Abraham, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring, and after you, throughout their generations. Didn't we just finish this?
Yeah, I thought so, but apparently not.
And there's more where that came from. Link to that podcast in the description. But suffice it to say that neither myself nor my daughter are terribly impressed with the quality of writing that can be found in this worldwide bestseller.
Fact, 100 million copies of the Bible are sold every year. Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion has sold 2 million.
So, the Bible, a book that Christians are made to feel obligated to buy for themselves, and which many of them purchase in bulk to hand out to people who wouldn't necessarily buy it on their own, sells more copies than a book that is not pushed on people like that. Therefore, the Bible is true? Sorry, but even if Bible sales weren't artificially inflated, that's just not how truth works.
5. The global spread of Christianity. Over the centuries, the gospel message has been vilified and ridiculed. Roman rulers threw first-century Christians to the lions, and 20th-century dictators sent believers to prison camps.
Yeah, but you skipped a huge segment of history there, where the most powerful military force in the world officially endorsed Christianity for almost 1,000 years. And even after that, the church used its political ties to prop up support of monarchies, which in turn ensured that the church retained its power.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition!
But I guess it sure would be impossible for a religion to grow when it's backed by the most powerful governments in the world for almost 1,500 years straight, right?
It is estimated that 70 million Christians have been martyred since the church began, and 40 million of those were in the 20th century.
So the vast majority of Christians who were martyred after the aforementioned power grab by the church, which spread itself with military strength. And this is supposed to be proof that God exists?
Yet today Christianity has more adherents than any religion, and numbers are growing in many parts of the world.
He had to include that many parts of the world caveat because Christianity is shrinking in many parts of the world, with a corresponding growth happening in the religiously unaffiliated populations. Well, if we look at the world as a whole rather than just the many parts of it, Islam is the fastest growing religion by far, and it's on track to become the dominant religion sometime around 2050. So if speed of growth is proof of God, then surely Allah is the one true God, right? Either that, or this is just a bad argument.
Our faith is spreading because it is the truth, and history shows that when this truth is mocked and scorned, it actually spreads faster.
Okay then, guess you'd better start practicing your Arabic, because apparently the Quran is only perfect if you can read it in its original language, and Islam is spreading way faster than Christianity. Only true things spread fast, right?
6. Jesus. The most amazing thing about God is not that he exists, but that he loved us so much he was willing to send his son to earth to save us from ourselves.
Allegedly.
Jesus was with the Father from the time of creation, and his arrival was predicted numerous times in Old Testament prophecy.
I have looked at the various lists of Old Testament prophecies, and they are, shall we say, less than impressive?
Finally, he interrupted history and came to live among us. His crucifixion is historical fact, and his resurrection was verified by hundreds of witnesses.
If I grant his crucifixion as an historical fact, his resurrection was verified by one single witness. Only one person from the time wrote down that they personally had seen a resurrected Jesus, and he wrote it in a way that's consistent with hallucination. All of the other witnesses are claimed to have been witnesses by other people, and the vast majority of them are never even named. How is it verification if the guy who has an interest in convincing you to believe what he's saying is also the one claiming that hundreds of other people saw it too? It's not, that's how.
The man who perhaps knew Jesus best, the Apostle John, saw the risen Christ and touched his nail-pierced hands.
I thought that Thomas was the one who got to finger Jesus' various holes.
He wrote, "What we have seen and heard we proclaim to you," 1 John 1:3.
I guess it's possible to interpret the first part of 1 John as being a claim to have touched Jesus in his holy bits, but it's more than a bit of a stretch. Now, maybe I'm wrong, maybe there is somewhere in the Bible where someone other than Paul actually claims to have seen a resurrected Jesus for themselves, but I have yet to see it, and if this weak, vaguely worded passage is the best you've got, then your best is kind of pathetic.
Jesus is not an elusive fairy tale. He is the living, breathing, touchable Son of God.
Well, then it should be no problem for me to be able to touch him, right? Care to introduce me to him sometime so I can poke his holes? If that is a true statement, then that should be a piece of cake.
7. My personal friendship with God. Atheists may not be convinced that God exists after listening to a storm, smelling a hibiscus, or reading the Bible. When I am asked to defend my faith, I don't start an intellectual argument. I have to go back to the words of Paul in 2 Timothy 1:12, "I am not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed."
Well, at least he's being honest about his position not being based on intellectual argumentation. But so far, we've got three variations on look at the trees, then the Bible says that God is real and we can trust the Bible because it's the word of God, followed by an argument that, if applied equally to all worldviews, would lead us to the conclusion that Islam is true, followed by Jesus, which is essentially a rewording of the Bible, because really, do you know anything about Jesus that isn't from the Bible? No, you don't. And now, the coup de grace of this entire article. You have an imaginary friend. These are supposed to be things that prove God is real. Prove doesn't leave any room for doubt, and yet these proofs barely rise to the level of argument.
There are many reasons I am convinced God is real. The existence of coffee alone proves that he loves me, but the best evidence is how he forgave me, changed me, and put unexplainable joy in my heart. And I can prove that.
Well, bully for the joy in your heart. I've got plenty of joy in my heart, and I don't need a God to explain it. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Danny C., who says, "Hey, Veist, when are we getting more of these?" This was on one of my Twit Tweets live streams, and the answer is, soon. I took the month of August off from live streaming because it was just crazy with kid stuff and summer stuff and a much needed week off, which hopefully you guys didn't even notice. But the Twit Tweets will be back in September, and I'm hoping to grab some guests to join me for them at that point, because the one time I did that was the most fun I had with any of them, and I think it turned out pretty well. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Mark McManus, Mark Hetchum, Clench Eastwood, Lynn Dobbs, What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the thunderstorms that prove the existence of the God that is my channel. If you'd like to prove my existence with a well-understood natural phenomena, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, which are linked in the description. If you'd like to listen to my videos in podcast form or listen to my podcast with my dog, the links for those are also in the description, as well as links to my social media accounts and my P.O. Box address. See you next time! Well, bully for the joy in your heart.
I've got the joy, 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 joy down in my heart. Down in my heart. Down in my heart. I've got the joy, 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 joy down in my fart.
What?